This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Our next speaker has you've already met Rod Fitzroy this morning, and we learnt about his passion for the history and traditions of the VRC, Flemington and the Melbourne Cup. And you can kind of understand why he has a passion, because each year in writing messages of welcome to overseas and interstate guests and in representing the VRC and the Cup at events around the world, he's had to contemplate the secret of the Cup's success. And while Australian racing in general has encountered many challenges, including competition from other sports and leisure activities, the Melbourne Cup Spring Carnival really remains a centrepiece of Australian life. And Victorian Premier John Brumby, I understand, recently claimed the Cup was more successful now than ever before. And I think that's got to be something to do with the chairman of the VRC. There's definitely got to be a role in there for Rod Fitzroy. But today he's going to address the topic, the Melbourne Cup. Why has it endured into the 21st century? Good luck or good management? Thanks, Rod.
I guess I can save all these notes because you probably know what my answer will be. But yes, I'm to respond to that question, that the 150th running of the Melbourne Cup, is it a product of good luck or good management? And in short, it's probably a little bit of one and a lot of the other. For without good management, all the good luck in the world would not have delivered for a century and a half an annual event that so commands the attention of the whole nation, as does the Cup. Whilst the VRC was not formed until 1864, which was actually 3 years after the first running of the Cup, it's fair to say that it has been the astute management of the VRC as custodians of the event that has enabled it to reach and maintain the position that it holds in Australian life today. The VRC, over its 146-year history, has had only 9 secretaries, as they were known then, or chief executives today, and the bar was set extremely high by the first two, Robert Cooper Baggett, and I think we're going to get a shot of Robert Cooper Baggett there, and Henry Byron Moore, were men of professional training and successful businessmen in their own right, and between them, they nurtured the development of the Cup for well over half a century. Interestingly, neither of them had a racing background, but they were clearly men of vision and drive, and who recognised the importance of the Melbourne Cup, and they both leveraged the event for the benefit of racing, the Victoria Racing Club, and for the City of Melbourne. Today, there are specialist companies who measure the success of so-called major events in terms of economic impact or economic uplift. Of course, in those early days of the Cup, there were no such tools to record the relative broader benefits of the Cup to the community, but no doubt substantial benefits there were. But what we do have, we don't have the benefit of these economic studies which are now undertaken not only around the Melbourne Cup but around all of the major events, the Grand Prix, the Australian Open Tennis, the Australian Rules Football Final in Melbourne. They're all measured in terms of economic impact and economic uplift, and that helps them all go to the government and get a bigger cheque to support them, except the VRC, because we don't get anything. But nevertheless, the Cup is the greatest contributor to economic activity in Melbourne amongst all of those major events. But going back to the 19th century, what we do have are first-hand accounts and illustrations of the Melbourne Cup carnivals of the first 50 years, and there can be no doubt that to manage an event of such magnitude in those times required expertise and business acumen of the highest order. In 1861, the Melbourne Cup attracted a crowd, and I think Brian referred to this earlier, of 4,000, and by 1880, a mere 2 decades later, 100,000 were drawn to Flemington from a Melbourne population of the time of only some 375,000. It's been calculated that if you had the same proportions today, we'd have about 1.25 million people at Flemington to watch the Cup each year. The logistics of hosting an attendance of this magnitude would really be beyond the capacity of many leading race clubs around the world today, but the VRC did it in the 19th century. An appreciation of the scale and grandeur of the Melbourne Cup in the late 19th century is provided by 3 magnificent paintings by the noted artist of the period, Carl Kahler. These paintings were bequeathed to the VRC and now form a prided place in the club's heritage collection. What these paintings clearly illustrate is less than 30 years after the first running of the Melbourne Cup, Flemington had been developed to accommodate crowds in the order of 100,000, and was the centre of style and sophistication reflective of the prosperity of Melbourne at the time. Can you imagine the economic benefit to retailers, hotels and other forms of accommodation, to restaurants, transport companies, be they hansom cabs or boats along the Maribyrnong River, or to the train service, which now by now had been connected, dedicated to the Flemington Railway Station right at the back of the course. These paintings enable us to imagine what it might have been like, but the words of the greatest global traveller of the time relate with clarity and a sense of amazement how big and how important the Melbourne Cup was before the turn of the 20th century. For it was Mark Twain who arrived in Melbourne just prior to the 1895 Melbourne Cup Carnival, and he recorded for posterity his observations of Flemington and the impact that the race had on the nation. In fact, the best part of a chapter of his book, Following the Equator, which was subsequently published in 1897, was devoted to his impressions of Melbourne and particularly the Melbourne Cup. And I do overdo quoting from Twain, and I'm going to do it again today, but I think in the context of the debate and discussion this morning that it is illustrative of how important the Cup was so early in its history. Twain, of course, was a man who could write with some authority about big events because basically he'd seen it all, from the great celebrations in his homeland of America through Europe. But in 1895, he wrote of his experience at Flemington. "It is the Melbourne Cup that brings this multitude together. Their clothes have been ordered long ago at unlimited cost and without bounds as to beauty and magnificence, and they have been kept in concealment until now, for until this day they are consecrated. I am speaking of the ladies' clothes, but you might know that. And so the grandstands make a brilliant and wonderful spectacle, a delirium of colour, a vision of beauty. The champagne flows, everybody is vivacious, excited, happy. Everybody bets, and gloves and fortunes change hands along the way. Day after day the races go on and the fun and excitement are kept at white heat. And when each day is done, the people dance all night so as to be fresh for the races the next morning." I'm not sure about that, but I think there is a sense of deja vu when you consider that these words were written in 1895, and I see a lot of that going on at Flemington in 2010. And at the end of the great week, the swarms secure lodgings and transportation for next year. They then flock away to their remote homes and count their gains and losses and order next year's cup's clothes, and then lie down and sleep 2 weeks and get up sorry to reflect that a whole year must be put in somehow or other before they can be wholly happy again. The Melbourne Cup is the Australasian National Day. It would be difficult to overstate its importance. It overshadows all other holidays and specialised days in whatever sort of congeries of colonies. Overshadows them? I might say it almost blots them out. Each of them gets attention, but not everybody's. Each of them evokes interest, but not everybody's. Each of them rouses enthusiasm, but not everybody's. In each case, a part of the attention, interest and enthusiasm is a matter of habit and custom, and another part of it is official and perfunctory. Cup Day and Cup Day only commands an attention, an interest and an enthusiasm which are universal and spontaneous, not perfunctory. Cup Day is supreme. It has no rival. I can call to mind no specialised annual day in any country which can be named by that large name, supreme. I can call to mind no specialised annual day in any country whose approach fires the whole land with a conflagration of conversation and preparation and anticipation and jubilation. No day save this one, but this one does it. I think it must be conceded that the position of the Australasian Day is unique, solitary, unfallowed, and likely to hold that high place a long time. They were certainly prophetic words written in 1895. So the Cup in the late 19th century already had a grip on the people of Australia, and I think it is illustrative that somebody with the experience of Mark Twain could put it in that sort of global context even in that time. But with the turn of the century and as a nation was founded, the Cup had well and truly entrenched itself as the most successful annual sporting and social event in Australia. And Henry Byron Moore, who took over from Baggett in 1881, reigned over the development of the Melbourne Cup until 1925, and his period in office was highlighted
by a drive for continuous improvement of the facilities at Flemington, be it the development of our now famous lawns and gardens, and innovations such as tea rooms, specifically targeted for the ladies. For it was Byron Moore who noted, if you can attract women, the men will follow. The first half of the 20th century was a challenging time for racing, which had to deal with the impact of two world wars and, of course, the Great Depression. However, the administrators during this period, both chief executives and committees, recognised the importance of the Cup, particularly in times of crisis, and were determined to see that the race went on and provided a reminder to our young men and women of what it was they were fighting for on foreign soils. The Cup represented the Australian way of life. Following the Second World War, crowds of 100,000 returned to Flemington, and it was a golden period for the champion horses such as Russia, Comic Court, Delta, Del Rey and Rising Fast, all of whom I think carried the number one saddle cloth, which indicated they defied the handicap conditions of the race. With the advent of the 60s, lifestyles in the now prosperous Australia were changing. Television and sporting and recreational pursuits other than football, cricket and racing were available to an ever more affluent society. Racing and the Cup faced new challenges. However, the love affair of the Australian people for their race never really waned. The first Tuesday in November still drew 100,000 to Flemington, and millions of Australians gathered around either the radio or TV, at home, at clubs, schools, outback bush race meetings, and even in federal parliament to join in the atmosphere of those at Flemington. The race was first televised in 1960, and so this year marks the 50th milestone of that auspicious occasion when the race was brought to the people of Australia. Reflecting on the words and actions of Byron Moore almost a century before, the committee of the day in the 60s launched Fashions on the Field and re-engaged the interest of women in racing and Cup Day in particular. And it was during this period that a decision was made to replace the beds of annual flowers with roses. And so a new feature of Flemington was started. And today, with 17,000 bushes, the roses are now synonymous with Flemington. But in 1993, perhaps the boldest move of all was undertaken by the then chairman, David Burke, chief executive, Rodney Johnson, and racing manager, Les Benton, when they hatched a plan that would see the best international stayers attracted to Flemington on a hit-and-run mission in an attempt to win our greatest prize. In that first year, two came, the English stayer Drum Taps and Vintage Crop from Ireland, who was trained by the Bart Cummings, if you like, of the Emerald Island, Dermot Well. It was a task that racing pundits of the day deemed impossible, to come halfway around the world and to win against Australasia's best stayers on their home turf. But in that year, Dermot Weld and Mick Canaan and their brave horse Vintage Crop proved that the impossible was possible. And so the internationalisation of the Melbourne Cup began, and every year since the race has been so much the richer for it, with challenges from Ireland, Dubai, England, France, Germany, Hong Kong, Japan, Singapore and South Africa. And in the period since Vintage Crop won the Cup in 1993, attendances at Flemington over the 4 days of the carnival have grown from 200,000 to 400,000. The national free-to-air television coverage of the Cup now extends to 120 international destinations and is watched by a global audience of many hundreds of millions. A Roy Morgan research poll in 2005 revealed that 63% of the adult population of Australia watched live as Mackaybee Diva created history with her third successive Melbourne Cup victory. That is 13 or 14 million Australians stopped work, as most of them were supposed to be doing because it's only a holiday in Victoria, and watched Mackaybee Diva. So the engagement of the Cup with the people is certainly alive and well today. The carnival now delivers an economic benefit of some $400 million to the Victorian economy and $700 million nationally. And it's perhaps the only major event in the world that provides an economic benefit beyond the boundaries of the state in which it is held. As we know, there's great competition between the states to host a Formula One race or an IndyCar race or whatever it is that the governments can attract to their state for the economic benefit that flows from it. But in fact, the running of the Melbourne Cup produces an economic benefit in every other state of Australia, and it's a significant one, amounting to some $300 million a year. There are more race meetings around Australia on Cup Day than any other day of the year. And it's not a public holiday, as I say, outside of Victoria. And that includes, of course, Australia Day, New Year's Day. But it's Cup Day where those outback bush communities come together to celebrate the Melbourne Cup for their annual race meeting. Today, the VRC's permanent staff of 170 expands progressively through the 7 months leading up to the Melbourne Cup Carnival to 1,200 during Carnival Week. There are 17,000 contractors and casual employees who are accredited to have access to Flemington prior to and during the Carnival. The footprint of the marquees that are erected each year is now over three times that of our three main grandstands. And by Derby Eve, the months of detailed planning are ready to be put to the test as 100,000-plus crowds are drawn to our historic racecourse for each of the 4 days of the Melbourne Cup Carnival. But it is the Cup that is the raison d'etre for it all. I have no doubt that it is and continues to be the good management of successive administrations that can rightfully lay claim to hosting the most successful 4-day racing carnival in the world. Today, the Cup is universally acknowledged as the staying championship of the world. And I feel confident that Captain Frederick Standish, the man who is generally credited as having conceived the conditions of the Cup in 1861, Robert Cooper Baggett, Henry Byron Moore, and those early custodians of the nation's great race would be both amazed and, I think, satisfied that the race they brought to fruition and then nurtured through the early years is in good hands as we move even closer to the 150th running of the race that stops a nation. So in closing, I must come down on the side of good management with perhaps a little bit of luck along the way. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.